Becker.
The podcast for London lovers, Anglophiles and critical believers. RevLab. Guten Tag, liebe Podcast-Community, liebe Freunde nah und fern. Wir sind zurück mit mehr Folgen von Morty Wicker. Und wir freuen uns riesig, dass ihr wieder dabei seid. Ich habe wieder viele spannende Gäste auftrieben. Menschen, die unsere Schweizer Kirche in London prägen und auch mich als Pfarrerin. Und Menschen, die im Grossstadtdschungel leben und überleben. Heute haben wir eine ziemlich weite Reise vor uns. Heute gehen wir nämlich nach Amerika, in die Vereinigten Staaten, zmitzt in Kuchen zu der Eastridge Presbyterian Church in Lincoln, Nebraska. Was haben wir dort echt verloren? Das ist eine Frage, die sich der Pfarrer von der Eastridge Church, der Thomas Dummermuth aus Bern, auch immer mal wieder stellt. Er erzählt uns heute, wieso er in Lincoln gelandet ist. Der Thomas und ich haben zusammen in Bern studiert. Und wenn ich den Thomas höre, ist das auch immer ein bisschen eine Reise zurück in die Vergangenheit. Ich habe Studieren geliebt. Nicht nur das, was man dort gelernt hat, sondern die ganze Intensität dieser Zeit. Das nächtelang diskutieren, das Verlieben und Entlieben, die Partys und die Freundschaften, die sich in dieser Zeit gebildet haben. Diese Jahre prägen mein Denken und Fühlen bis heute und sind ein Teil von mir. Jetzt während der Pandemie sind Studierende weltweit um diese prägende Erfahrung betrogen. Und das ist einfach nicht fair. Studieren ist so viel mehr als Anhäufen von Wissen. Meinungen bildet man sich im Streitgespräch in der Cafeteria. Und Freundschaften, die man an der Uni schliesst, sind häufig fürs Leben. Und viele finden in dieser Zeit auch den Lebenspartner oder die Lebenspartnerin. Das fällt alles weg für die, die während der Pandemie studieren. Und ich glaube, man darf nicht unterschätzen, was das für psychische Konsequenzen hat, aber auch Konsequenzen für die Lebenspläne, Wünsche und Hoffnungen von jungen Menschen. Ich kann mich noch besonders gut erinnern, wie wir amigs nach einer langen Partynacht bei einer Studienfreundin auf der Terrasse gelegen sind, sie hat noch Matratzen rausgetan, und die Welt und Gott erklärt haben. Theologiepartys haben nebst den Geologie-Partys zu den besten Uni-Partys in unserem Jahrgang gehört. Das würden wir uns Theologen ja vielleicht gar nicht so zutrauen. Aber Feste, das haben wir können. Heute rede ich mit dem Thomas nicht auf dem Balkon, sondern auf Zoom über Politik, Auswandern und über Kirche in Amerika. Für mich ein Buch mit 7 Siegeln.
Welcome everyone. I'm with Thomas Dummermuth, a former study friend of mine. We studied Reformed theology together at the University of Bern. And Thomas made it all the way across the Atlantic Ocean to Lincoln, Nebraska, where he is the minister of Eastridge Presbyterian Church.
That's correct.
And I am in good old Britain. So thanks for talking to me today, Thomas.
Well, thank you very much for having me this afternoon.
And I think we both really love to speak in Swiss German together, but this one, I'm afraid, is going to be for the wider public and our congregations as well. So it's going to be in English.
Right, right. And to be honest, sometimes I struggle with finding German words after all those years. I also sometimes struggle to find the English word, but it goes along just fine usually.
Did you receive my email I sent you?
I just opened it up, yeah.
Because the thing is, usually I would just have a series of questions that I go through. There are just 5 things on this list. You can take your pick. And maybe I just read them out, the topics that I would like to talk to you about, so everyone knows. And then you pick which one you would like to start with. So the first one is riots on Capitol Hill, presidential elections, United States in recent months and years. What's going on? The second one, how did you end up in Lincoln, Nebraska and at the Eastridge Presbyterian Church? The third one, probably my favorite, is Christianity and churches and the Americans. I just can't quite get my head around it. Can you please shed some light on that? The fourth one, Switzerland and you. And the fifth, if we have time and if you want to talk about it, memories from university time.
Let's talk with the safest one. Let's talk how I ended up here in Lincoln, Nebraska, in East Ridge Presbyterian Church. I think that is, I think by way of introduction, I think we won't get around talking to the other ones, and they are really, really good topics and very tumultuous ones. And I'm glad to share my perspective on that and talk a little bit about those things. But yeah, how did I end up in Lincoln, Nebraska? In the middle of nowhere, or as some people like to say, the middle of everywhere, because we're literally in the middle of the U.S. In Nebraska, which is for a lot of people a white spot on the map.
You know what? I have to look it up every time that I talk to him. It's like, oh, hang on a minute, where is it again? And then I quickly go on Google Maps just to make sure I have a rough idea.
So, I mean, Nebraska by itself is a very vast, people don't know much about Nebraska, maybe Bruce Springsteen's album or something like that. Some people have pictures of countryside, wide open spaces, and that's true, a lot of agriculture and so on. It's super flat, no mountains here. A little bit in the west, they're called the Sand Hills. So it is very different from Switzerland. The short answer is I followed my love and migrated to the US. Jen and I met each other, oh gosh, 19 years ago. It would be 20 years this summer in Vienna, Austria. We were both backpacking Europe and we crossed each other's paths. And my version is we stayed in the same hostel. Her version is we were in different hostels, but we went out on a night with a couple friends from hostel friends and to a bar. And with the group of people, we talked about God and the world and everything all night long. And I liked her. And then we went different directions. And I said, I'm going to go to Budapest next. And she said, oh, we're already going to go to Budapest tomorrow. So we met up again in Budapest. But that was it. I mean, we exchanged emails and said bye. And at some point I told her, if you lived a little closer, maybe that would be something. So we did that before sunset or before sunrise or something.
Oh, yeah.
Like that. Yeah. went different ways and kind of lost touch of each other. Maybe send each other the annual happy birthday or something like that. And I think it was in summer 26 that Bill Gates hooked us up again. I ran my contact list through the MSN Messenger back in the day. That was like early days of chatting on the computer. I got a match. And so I added her to my contact list and she got a message, Thomas wants to talk to you. And then we started talking for a long time, pretty much every day, every night for me late at night. And she would run home after medical school so she could chat. And we really got to know each other through these online conversations. And it was not till like way over a year later, fall 2017, that she said, well, that's stupid. This one day, maybe someday we see each other again. Are you around in November? And so she came over in November 2007 and that we knew we were in a big trouble because in a big mess, because if that was ever going to go somewhere, one of us would have to make a decision that you usually are not ready to make at this stage of a relationship.
It's interesting what you say, because that's how I met my partner, Julian, now husband as well, like that you have this first contact and then your relationship really starts by just talking on the phone or online or whatever, because you are apart, and how you get to know each other. You really, that's the only thing you can do really, is just talk and get to know each other that way. And somehow I think it's a really special way to start a relationship and then make that decision to meet up. Obviously in your case, a much bigger decision. I mean, London, Zurich, it's kind of around the corner. But United States and Europe, I mean, that's a pretty big step. So how did you come to the decision to move? And also, I must say, I think it's really unusual that you, the man, follows the woman. And I think it's great.
It was a really hard decision because I loved my life in Switzerland. I loved my parish ministry there. I worked with a great colleague. I lived in Fribourg, which is still one of my favorite cities in Switzerland. People in Bern would say, really? Okay. because of that rivalry there. I mean, we did this for a while, the long distance thing. And 2007, 2008, we visited each other when we could, which was a couple times a year. But it's so hard to be close again and distant and so on. And so we knew something would need to change. It was really a little wrestling because for me, and as you said, it's rather unusual for the guy to leave. It was from the beginning very clear. If someone were to leave, it would be me. And that has mostly reason with the education, that certification, the board certification of my wife, who's a medical doctor in the US. It will be more complicated to do the accreditation in a different country, plus the language and so on. And I have from my exchange here in the US some connection to the church world in the US. So I knew there would be a way in. The churches would not be as bureaucratic about ordination standards and so on. So for me, the way would be more open than for her. And then that's a personality thing. I struggled with that because it was so clear. I felt like we don't really consider both options on the same level. But in the end, it was really like I would not forgive myself not giving it a try.
Now you're established at the Eastridge Presbyterian Church. You have three children as well. You really live there now. And looking back, maybe before we talk about the church, did you anticipate the kind of dimension of your decision when you moved over? Or was it more like you just followed the adventure, you followed your love, and then see how things fall in place?
Yes, no. I think I'm a worrier, so I anticipate pretty much every scenario. But at the same time, I'm in a situation right now in the heartland of the U.S. in a very different part than what people usually know of the U.S. ministering in the church context, a different kind of Christianity, even where I realize, I would have never thought my life to play out like that, and it's weird and fun at the same time.
It is what it is.
Wow. It is my life. Looking back, it's like, that is so, I mean, it's awesome. It's wonderful. I think there's an element of serendipity, or I hesitate to call like predestination and a reorganization on that level in there, because those are dangerous things to use for our human decisions. But I think it's really good. And I love my life here. And at the same time, I sometimes wonder, it's like, this is so random that I'm here. It's like weird. And the interesting thing is my wife, she grew up in Nebraska, but went to college in Vegas and medical school in Kansas City, and then to residency in West Virginia. So all over the US. And she sometimes says a similar thing. It's so weird to end up in my home state again. I think weirdness is on any kind of biographical track of possibility.
Very true. You know, sometimes I think, because I have that feeling of like, how did I end up here? Why do I live in London? I sometimes think of you and think, well, you know, Thomas lives in Lincoln, Nebraska.
You say, it could be weirder, like, right? Weirder, yeah.
Well, it's anyway, I think it's really good to know that I'm not alone, and that it's two of us who somehow ended up abroad with our degrees from Bern.
And that is something I really appreciate. As we were talking recently, I really thought it's really something that is good talking about and relating to. And I don't think a lot of people share that experience. I feel sometimes, what's the theological term in the Christology? The undivided and whatever, the dual natures of Christ. I feel like that's become true of my life here. I naturalized a year ago or 15 months ago. So I'm an American citizen now. I have an American family. I am really American here, but at the same time, I'm still 100% Swiss. And there's no way to get rid of that.
Should we talk about Switzerland and you?
Of course, with the current mess going on, I miss the boring politics of Switzerland. The system that is so geared toward compromise and consensus and making sure the minority voice is heard and so on. And yeah, that's kind of something that I never really appreciated while I had it, because it does not make for much exciting politics in the Swiss context. And over here, I'm like, ooh, yeah, I wish some of that. I wish there were some institutional way to hear each other and build a relationship across bridges and so on. Because I think that's very much a part of the Swiss identity too. And something that people coming from the outside often don't understand how that can work with four different cultures and many more cultures, and a way that's become part of a system that makes sure that minority voices are heard.
Which is kind of weird, because the United States is such an immigrant country as well. And it's partly based on the political system of Switzerland, isn't it? Yet it's so different how things work in day-to-day politics.
I think it's the opposite. I think we're based on the US.
Oh, is it? I got that
wrong. It's one of the oldest modern democracies, if you don't count the Greek and so on, with the constitution and so on, a really foundational document.
Yeah, historically, it makes sense. Yeah, I don't know why I got that wrong. You know what? I'm going around telling everyone how the US is based on the Swiss political system, but I think that's just...
Let's just tell everyone, okay, because maybe they start listening to the Swiss.
Yeah. But yeah, it makes sense. If you look at the centuries and the history of it, it makes more sense the other way around.
The similarities are there with the chambers, Senate and the House and so on. Where it's different is on the top level, where in this weird Swiss council is. How do you even explain that to someone?
It's a tricky one. But let's not go there. We have talked about Switzerland and you.
I hinted at that. I did an exchange here in the US in a Presbyterian seminary in Richmond, Virginia. Our University of Bern theological faculty has still, I think, a partnership with Richmond, Virginia. And so I got to spend a year there and was able to make connections to the Presbyterian Church, which is close relative to the Swiss Reformed. The Presbyterians, you know, probably as much about it. They're based on the Reformation in Geneva and then took a detour through Scotland and from there into all the world. Scottish heritage is very important to my folks here, and I never have anything to say about that. I've never been to Scotland. Debate a little bit what's really the motherland. So I had connections to the Presbyterian Church. When I came over here, my then girlfriend was doing residency in West Virginia, and I worked at a church for 2 years in West Virginia in the Presbyterian Church in Ravenswood and Ripley. They accepted my ordination, as I mentioned, and I was able to be first a corresponding member, and then over those 2 years became naturalized in the church context. And then when I got married and moved to Lincoln, I was looking around and I had nothing to do and went to visit churches every Sunday. And looking back, that's the last time I really went visiting churches as someone who's not a pastor, which was a lot of fun. But it was one of those churches that I literally walked in the right time. They were in the interim period, and the interim pastor heard that I was ordained minister and not currently employed in a church. And she said, "I have work for you." So I started first, was more kind of on a volunteer basis, and then I became part-time and then made full-time and then made official. So there was still a little process like that. Eastridge Presbyterian Church is part of the PCUSA, the Presbyterian Church in the USA, one of the old mainline denominations in the US.
And with that, can you answer the big, big question?
Christianity and the Americans.
Christianity and the Americans.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what I never quite get is that religion seems to be like so private, but at the same time, you have to have an affiliation to a church. How does that work?
You, as a historian, know that you just mentioned it recently. First people came to the U.S. based on religious persecution with the intent to wanting to live their faith freely the way they understand it. So that's part of the founding myth of the U.S., that this religious component, this freedom of religion, which in the U.S. is mostly freedom to express your faith, is part of who you are. I really don't know the history that much to say that with confidence, but my impression was always, at least until very recently, the understanding was you could worship anywhere you want, but you should worship somewhere. You should be involved in a church community somewhere. And I was wondering, does that have something to do with the American understanding of freedom, which is mostly an American understanding of choice out of a selection of options? When I think about church membership in Switzerland, and I think probably much of the continent, it's more in the sense that many people are still in a form of distant membership, but their way of involvement is I'm a little bit or I'm not very involved kind of thing. And in the US, it's like you're part of Presbyterian Church or a Methodist or a Baptist and so on. You have like options to choose from, ice cream flavors to choose from. And then the expectations is that's more part of your identity, I think.
So is it really like that where you live in your neighborhood, the people you know, your friends, are they all part of a church, everyone? Or are there people who don't follow that one written rule?
I think the US is in a very fast change right now where that church connection is getting much looser in a development of becoming more secular in a way that much of Europe has been familiar with that for decades. I think the US is catching up in a very fast rate. Younger people are not necessarily staying in churches or going back to where their parents go. They may join one of those more contemporary churches or non-denominational churches that have a very excited produced program and geared toward your age and so on. There are really fast changes in place. And so what I was just saying before, that a family was a Presbyterian family or a Methodist family or an Anglican family or a Baptist, or, and I'm just talking in the Christian world, of course, that's true for other religion traditions too. People don't just stay in their lane anymore. Often there's still a lot of people who do join a church, but denominations, I think, as such, are a model that I don't know how long they're going to survive. There's still that understanding that faith is part of your life and also your public life. I don't foresee in an immediate future to have an American president who doesn't end his speeches or their speeches with God bless America. It is kind of part of, while there is this separation of church and state, there is not really a separation of faith and politics. I think that is very intertwined and often in messy and ugly ways.
Yeah, that's what I find some surprising, that one of the first questions of any presidential candidate is, what church do you belong to? But you explained that really well. I think it's certainly it's to do with that history. What surprised you most about church, your church, the Presbyterian church, when you started in the first place, and what still surprises you?
I think one thing that is different here from the very get-go is ministry doesn't happen in a parochial context. You don't have your Kirchgemeinde, your slice on the map, and you're in charge of that kind of as the religious service provider. As many of the churches in Switzerland still function that way, there's still some different models there as well. So in that sense, it is a market situation. Also, a big part of that is the importance of fundraising, encouraging people to give, or that giving is part of discipline or being a member.
How do you do that?
I personally do it very poorly because I struggle to be the one to raise my own funds, sing for being paid kind of thing. That is, and I can shake off that perception sometimes. So that's probably one of the harder things I realize here. And I like the diffused financial tracks, more bureaucratic tracks of finances in Switzerland, where you don't really know who really paid your salary, which there's also a freedom in there that you don't are accountable in the terms that you need to say what the people in the front of you want to hear. That is something that still surprises me to that extent, that when I may go out there a little bit, you might make someone so upset that they leave the church and take their contribution with them.
You have to be a bit more careful, I think, in terms of how political you are as well and what you say, which brings us to the next topic everyone wants to hear about.
the one I've been trying to avoid. No, I don't want to avoid. I think it's such an important topic. I struggle with it because it's so imminent. It's just so recent, and we're still in the thick of it. And
we're talking, of course, about the presidential elections, about the riots on Capitol Hill, etc.
Correct. And I think that's an earthquake. I don't really know what the appropriate words to describe that is. Knowing from what everything we know is it could have been much worse, but there is an element of an attack on the symbols of the central institutions of the United States. In that way, I think it's in a way comparable to a 9/11. I mean, it really shakes the soul of America, I think, in a way.
And what do you say as a minister in church when you have Republicans, Democrats? Well, to be fair, of course, a lot of Republicans are not Trumpists, but you might also have people who still support Trump. So what do you say on a Sunday in church?
Again, it's a difficult topic because on one hand, I'm not trying to be partisan, and I think the church is not party. At the same time, it does not excuse us from speaking the truth to power. And there's always a little question, do I speak to the choir or do I try to say something that reaches someone who might not see things the way I see? So what do I say? I think one thing I have not preached since, so you were preaching, so that I'm very glad about that. So, but it's coming up. And one thing I feel drawn to is understanding how our words have power. Our words create realities, which goes again to the core of Western civilization, which is to some extent the freedom of speech. There's words that have consequences, real life consequences and bloody consequences. When you tell a large group of people that the election was stolen, when you tell them ahead of time, it's going to be rigged. script, and then it comes out that way. And the way it came out with the certain states that were not allowed to open their mail-in votes until everything else was counted, and then you see the count change on TV. These, I can see how someone gets the sense that something has been taken from us, especially if people from your party or your president even told you to believe that. So there's a larger context where people have fostered a narrative, a false narrative, and played with very basic human emotions of fear and anger, I think. I think in a way there's a beast out of a box. The question is, how do you go forward with that? Everyone, both sides, Republicans, Democrats, now speak of healing of the nation and so on. What element plays justice in that role? What does truth-telling play a role? But then again, how important it is that when you have other important items on your agenda in Congress where you want to decide how to deal with this pandemic that's still going on? And it is a mess. It is a mess.
And I hope you find the words for your next sermon.
But one thing I'm keep thinking is, obviously we need to do something, but we also need to not doing something stupid in reaction to this. And I'm thinking, as someone who lived in Switzerland during 9/11, that was the moment I felt like the whole world stood with the American people for like 2 minutes. There was still always some anti-Americanism going on, particularly in college level and so on, and the left in Europe. But that moment was like everyone sympathized or empathized with the United States. And at the same time, it was when then President George W. Bush came out and said, we're going to hunt them down, the last one, when I just felt this goosebumps, this shudder going down my back. Because if the reaction to being violated in your most sacred identity is one of wrath and destruction, what are going to be the consequences? And you see today, two wars later, that no one really knows how to end, and Guantanamo Bay that no one knows how to close, and so on. You see consequences in daily life as we go through security for on the airplanes and so on.
We have to come to the end of the recording. No, it's great. I see you can go on forever about this. No, but it's really, really interesting to have your insight and your opinion on that. I would like to end on a like positive memory. If you could pick one top best memory from your time at the University of Bern, what would that be?
I loved studying in the Uniban and many things about that. But when I have to pick one thing, it's probably the courtyard behind the building where we had lunch, and those never-ending lunches, you know, where we missed lectures or we were going to go study in the library, but we sat there on those tables. And yes, sometimes conversation was silly, but often it was things we learned and study, and that exchange, that communication about these matters of faith and life and politics and everything would happen there. And I think in some way formed my my pastoral identity in a way as much as any book or any lecture would have done. Those long lunches, we don't have long lunches enough anymore.
And I couldn't agree with you more. That's so formative. And I must say, I find it so hard for students today, like with the pandemic and the restrictions, that they are deprived from that. Because I think these discussions and informal lunches and being together is so formative, and it really helps you shape your opinion and discussing things that you've heard, you learned, you think. And this is just being taken away from students during this pandemic. And I think they're really maybe a forgotten group, but it's hard on them. And I really feel for them that they have to learn alone in their rooms on computer and not having that real life exchange with their peers. I have very good memories of that as well. And do you remember how hot it was in summer? Because it was the courtyard, it was all stone, and it really became so hot. It just really heated up. And then everyone was trying.
Fry an egg on the table.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh yeah, the tables became like really boiling hot, and we were trying to catch a spot under one of the few umbrellas there were. I remember that very well. good old times. Thomas,
it was really good ideas.
So good talking to you. And
Likewise.
I hope this is the beginning of maybe the pandemic brought us somehow closer again, and to have more exchange with you, exchange of experience. And all the best, and have a good lunch. I'm preparing for dinner. And awesome. Big wave over the Atlantic.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me, and glad to be a transatlantic guest for once. Yeah.
Mein nächster Gast bringt uns wieder zurück nach London und ins Herz der Schweizer Kirche. Fernand Kunz aus Davan ist 1963 als junge Frau nach London gezogen und geblieben. Sie erzählt, wie sich die Bedeutung der Swiss Church über die Jahrzehnte verändert hat, warum sie sich als alleinstehende Person trotz der Corona-Einschränkungen nicht einsam fühlt und was für Chancen Online-Gottesdienst bietet. Hört rein. RevLab.